does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
This is Trackside with Kirk Cavan and Kevin Lee.
They'll head to the start-finish line, waiting for the sign from the starter, waiting for the green flag. It flies at the 2022 Indianapolis 500, roars into turn number one. Connor Daly takes a peek to the inside of Scott Dixon at the start-finish line.
And you can hear the crowd. They jump to their feet, and they start pumping those fists. Connor Daly, the Hoosier, to the top spot at Indy.
Davey Hamilton, a drive-through penalty for Scott Dixon.
I seen when he came in, he sped. He had the tires locked up on pit entry.
And Nick Yeoman, you saw Marcus Erickson make the pass.
Set him up like we've seen so many times down into turn number one. And Jake, we see down the backstretch, Marcus Erickson's pulling away.
The final couple of laps of the 106th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Green flag is in the air of the starter. They are at speed, and Marcus Erickson trying to move around to disrupt that air. He gets to the start-finish line first. And the white flag flies on the 106th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Pato Warren to the high-sided one.
He jumps to the outside. They go wheel-to-wheel, but Pato has to jump out of the throttle. Marcus Erickson leads to the short shoot.
Quiet Swede quietly has made his way to the front, and now a half a lap away from winning his very first Indianapolis 500. And Carlix, as he swings low, now back high to turn three for the final time.
Marcus Erickson is snaking around. Pato Ward and Tony Kanaan are skulking with Felix Rosenquist. Marcus Erickson with a 5-car length advantage, and the caution flag has come out due to an incident in turn number two, Mark.
Marcus Erickson flies under the twin checkers, and he has achieved racing immortality. He wins the 106th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Hello, welcome. Trackside 93.5, 107.5, the fan in Indianapolis. Thanks for joining us tonight. Josh Molnix is in Indianapolis. I'm Kevin Lee. I'm not in Indianapolis, but I'm not far away. Kirk Cavan also, I don't think, is in Indianapolis proper, but he's not far away. Thanks for joining us. Big program tonight. Later on in the show, the brand new COO of Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan Racing, longtime top executive at Honda Performance Development, recently with Chip Ganassi Racing. Steve Erickson is going to be on the show tonight. It is a tradition. Most every year, we have our correspondent from the Chili Bowl in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dylan Welch is driving once again, trying to make the A-Main again. He will join us from Tulsa with cars in the background coming up in about an hour or so. And also a new motorsport media venture that we'll tell you about a little later on in the program. Thank you for being on the show tonight. I believe it's January 10th, Kurt. And I believe for the second time on a show day, I got outside. So I'm in a good mood. It was, you know, my 50-80 rule. I don't go outside and run if it's below 50. I did break that on New Year's Eve because it was sunny. And it was New Year's Eve, and I went out on a 43-degree run. Today it was 52, and I'm a little bit hustled to get ready because I got started late. I actually came back, and it was pretty much dark. Tried to catch up on some things, so we'll kind of make it up as we go along. But I think I know what our number one topic is, beyond the fact that it's 52 degrees in Indianapolis in January, and it feels like we can go to the racetrack anytime, and in many cases – Mini will coming up in, a week and a half. I think the 11th IndyCar driver was named to a Rolex 24 ride today with Will Power. So we'll get into that a little bit later on. But we probably have to start with the latest soap opera. Is that the way to describe it, with the Andretti Global Group's efforts and continuing, and I think in all of our opinions, ability to strengthen what they bring. And yet again, it's a ho-hum. Really, what are you bringing? We don't need that. This is amazing the way this is all going down.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. It's not as fascinating as Alex Palou driving for two different teams in the same, you know, breath, or at least the same week. But this is interesting. Andretti, I thought, already had a strong enough case for permission to be involved in Formula One and to, you know, build that tradition of American motorsports in F1. But lo and behold, they're not happy with the decision, or at least their ho-hum decision, I think, or ho-hum reaction. I think you described it pretty well, by the Formula One community to Cadillac, the Cadillac brand, and General Motors in general supporting and being involved with Andretti Global's efforts to put an F1 program together. How much General Motors is going to be involved still, I think, is to be determined. Is this kind of a sponsorship? Is this an active participation? Are they going to build motors in the future? You know, there's all these things, and I think we have a sense, but I don't know that we have the complete pathway to participation laid out in front of us yet. But regardless of that, this was big news that General Motors is going to be involved in the Formula One effort. And, you know, this is a big timer. And if you're any other motorsports series, you would expect that it would be welcome news that General Motors wanted to participate. And yet, you know, we don't live in the F1 world, so it's a little difficult for us to get our heads around why someone wouldn't want a player of that nature to be involved. I mean, it's just huge, huge news. And, you know, we can get into it a little bit more, but it sounds like Honda could become alongside the partnership to have Andretti, to have Michael, to have Mario, to have Colton Herta, perhaps all these, you know, big elements that we see as big elements, at least, are pretty much pushed to the side by the people who want to keep their pot of money intact. And it's I would look at it like, let's grow the pot of money, but apparently they don't see it that way. And so we will watch this saga continue to unfold.
And by the way, Forbes.com had a story from Bruce Martin today, who talked to Michael Andretti, who is adamant that this is not just Cadillac and GM badging an engine. It goes deeper than that. Yes, the first year would be badged because there's not enough time. But they are going to be involved in the development. Now, the other side could argue semantics in that, you know, you can always say that you're adding some technical expertise, but what are the full innards? But beside that, I'll try to summarize some things. So, you know, I like to cut and paste things, but there's been so much written in the last week on this. I got like four pages. So I know we all enjoy reading with Kevin, but not to that extent. So I'm going to kind of try to make it up as I go along, and then you add in and correct from your recollection what we have. Now, I think I mentioned last week on the show a positive comment from FIA President Mohammed bin Sulaiman that, you know, expressed more support for Michael Andretti. And now we see why, because then a couple of days later, we got the release combined with Cadillac and Andretti about them working together. And then I saw another tweet from, and that he's only one half of the entity. So it's not like he can just green light things. The other half is Formula One management and the teams. So bin Sulaiman cannot just say, I want them, they're in. It takes more than that. But he sent out then after this came out and there was some pushback. His tweet was, it's surprising there's been some adverse reaction to the Cadillac and Andretti news. The FIA has accepted the entries of smaller successful organizations in recent years. We should be encouraging prospective F1 entries from global manufacturers like GM and throughout, with racers like Andretti and others. Interest from teams in growth markets adds diversity and broadens F1's appeal. And what keeps coming back? So originally, the criticism of Michael's entry was, well, one, they didn't like that he went public with it. This is the wrong way. Really? You know, this is coming from a group of team principals who like to bicker on the broadcasts about penalties and use every public forum they have to try to get what they want. Okay, if that's what you want to spend, that's fine. And then it was, well, it needs to be additive. The Andretti name is not enough. And essentially, it's how much money are you going to make us? That's only going to take away 10% of our profit, because essentially the pie is split 10 ways. And if now we're splitting in 11 ways, That pie needs to grow. What are they doing to grow that pie? And so, okay, we'll come back at you. Now, one way they're growing the pie is it was a $200 million expansion fee, but that's short term. So that gives them some money for now, but the way Formula One is growing, okay, we got to revisit that. So you bring in Cadillac and GM, and as you said, any other racing entity is going to say, that's it. That's all we need. Count them. Lock it in, you're done. But these other owners, they're not looking out for the greater good. They're not looking that GM is going to help market and brand. It is all, and this, I think, goes back to the Bernie Ecclestone model, which, by the way, was very successful. Bernie made them all a lot of money, but it's no, what is the short-term monetary value? We can look at long-term, but it's all about the money. And if it's not specifically making us money, then no, this is not how we all became bazillionaires. Kurt, I think that is a challenge. And as this news was breaking, I happened to be talking with someone that would probably be in our world, have more insight on Formula One than most of the other people we have contact to. And his immediate reaction is, this changes nothing because it doesn't bring in immediate new cash. So that's still another obstacle. I think everyone would agree for the greater good, this has got to help grow the sports. But if it's not taking the pot from, if say you're making $500 million a year to $600 million a year, then they're not interested. They'd still prefer them to stay out.
Yeah, that's kind of the sad thing from those of us who love competition and love the sport. And we have difficulty getting our heads around it, you know, because you do this work, you know, we do this work on the heat, on the backs of the sponsors, largely, you know, people invest money, you know, it's publicity, it is ratings, it is, you know, and it's, so it's not just cash. It's not just a cash game. At least that's how, you know, how we see so many sports entities grow is just through publicity. And I think, you know, we can talk about how Formula One has made a difference and made an impact and is growing in the U.S., but it still has a long way to go. And, you know, the muscle that General Motors can add to the program in the U.S. in terms of visibility, in terms of sponsorship, in terms of just, you know, creating news in the in the motorsports world, you know, is real, and it will lead to money. You know that. I know that.
Yep.
It will lead to money. And, you know, we talk about the greater good, but I think from the greater good financially, it would certainly grow the North American market at a rate that Formula One could still benefit from. But obviously, we don't see it the way they see it.
I think many of the owners, many of the people in Formula One are begrudgingly helping to grow the American market. That's been a stumbling block for a while. And I think it took an American company like Liberty to get that going. And now it's, well, we can't turn down the money. So, okay, we'll race there three, four times, however many times a year. We'll take their money. But I think there's a strong possibility. Their fear is, okay, this is good. We're now taking the Americans' money, and more teams, not only are we racing in America and collecting $30 million sanctioning fees, although maybe that's not exactly true because I think there might be a bit of a discount from Liberty to grow the sport in America, but many of the teams are now doing American partnership deals. And I think that they fear, I think they see this now as an untapped market that we'll go in and take these Rube's money and take it back to the UK. Well, if Andretti, a true American team, because Haas F1 is not an American team at all, other than the owner lives in America. But if they have a true American team with a headquarter like they're building in Fishers and an American manufacturer, whether it's a branding exercise or not, and an American driver like Colton Herta, and potentially a second American driver as well, this would be the first true American team since Dan Gurney, right? And that marketing money is more likely than going to go to a brand like Andretti, which already has Formula One, sells itself, But you add in having access to Michael and Mario. That's something that Williams doesn't offer. No one offers that.
And I think, you know, certainly in this part of the world, so North America, but largely the U.S., I think part of the fear is that Andretti is a bigger star than almost everything in Formula One this side of Ferrari.
Agreed. They don't want that.
They don't want that. You know, no. I think if you were rating brands in Formula One, and now it may depend on which country you're in, I get that. But I think if you were to just take an overall global motorsports list of brands and rank them, I mean, you would obviously start with Ferrari. And after that, you're pretty, it doesn't go very far to get to Andretti. And so that's a rub for a lot of people. You know,
look at the way the Sky F1 broadcast, when Mario is on site, the way they treat him. These are people from England. This isn't Lee Diffie, David Hobbs, and Steve Matchett, who are based in the United States. This is Crofty and the other Martin Brundle and the others that have no interest in America, have no understanding of America, but Mario Andretti resonates.
And look, he's not going to be around, you know, forever, but the Andretti name would resonate in every corner of the sport. And in particular, to the point you were making, it resonates in every boardroom in the U.S. If you're going to spend money, if you can't spend it with Ferrari and become a major player on the Ferrari team, you know, then you're probably going to look to the Andretti team because it's truly American. Now they have global, you know, businesses, and maybe for some companies that's not as important as it is for others. But there's a reason, and this is a big topic and maybe a topic for a whole nother show, but there's a reason why Zac Brown has become has really risen the profile of McLaren. You know, McLaren went through a period where it didn't have the clout that it does and has mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. past. He has done that and really built the brand into one of the biggest, you know, brands in Formula One. Obviously not Ferrari, but it's pretty big. And the Andretti thing, you know, really strikes at that. The interesting thing is Zac Brown's, he recognizes in a positive way what the Andretti name means for the sport, but it's in conflict with a lot of those teams. I mean, a lot of those teams, you know, don't have much of a natural brand pull. You know, kind of go down through the list of teams. It's a pretty short list of teams that can instantly walk into, you know, regardless of the F1 participation, just to walk into a boardroom and say, look at us, you know, but a Ferrari can do that. A McLaren can do that. A Mercedes can do that. And an Andretti could do that.
So apologies, because this is an IndyCar show, for talking so much about Formula One. And I think we all in some ways have grown weary of the fascination and growing spotlight shown on Formula One. Sometimes to some people thinks the detriment of IndyCar, but this is where I'm headed with this. And I've been in the camp. So a lot of people get really annoyed and offended when any of the IndyCar drivers say, yeah, I'd like to do Formula One. My position on that has always been, hey, I get it. If, you know, I love my job, but if someone says you can host Monday Night Football and it's going to pay you 15 times what you're making, you know, I'm a fool if I'm not listening to that. So I get that. Those jobs pay more. And, you know, frankly, it's just a slightly more impressive car. So whatever. But some of the things that I saw associated with this story, And I know some people have felt like, hey, let's go out and let's stop bowing down to Formula One and saying all high tides raise all boats. Let's fight with them and compete. And I'm starting to wonder if that's maybe not the path that we need to take. When you see quotes like this, Adam Stern retweeted this from the BBC. Within F1, there is a general sense that many of those racing in American categories where teams buy cars off the shelf and run them with fairly small scale operations don't quite grasp just how high the level is in F1 and how complex the task. So credit to Nathan Brown for being the first to immediately retweet the picture of the totally blank Kyle Kaiser-Hunkos car bumping out the McLaren in the Indy 500. So, okay, if it's so easy, why didn't you all make the Indy 500? And then he pulled up a quote from Michael Andretti from a year and a half or so ago, too, saying it's a joke the way Europeans look at themselves all the way up here and we're down there. As he mentions near his chest line, they're so ignorant about American talent. So I'll repeat. They think we're rubes. They're just here to take our money. Maybe this all blows up on them and the American fan base becomes annoyed. But actually, I fear that's not the case because a lot of the new fandom, the Drive to Survive fan, they're not reading motorsport. They're oblivious to this. If it's not covered in the new Drive to Survive that comes out in March, they're not going to know about this. So they do that. And then they like to come to the races. They're not really paying attention to the race, but it's the thing to do right now. But maybe there's another path to this. If they ultimately do stonewall Andretti from getting in here, who has the budget to do this, do we try to convince them to get, what is it, the Guggenheim Group, the kind of the money behind Gainsbridge that is willing to fund all this? Can we get them to double or triple down? Maybe that's the path. Maybe they're going to be so angry if they do get shut out with check in hand. And I suspect they're willing to go above that $200 million entry fee as well to try to get them to triple down on IndyCar, invest. Let's make the cars sound cooler, look better, grow the events. It's still at a fraction of the cost to invest of what Formula One is, work a way to have the broadcast, have limited commercial operations. That could all be done for well less than it would cost them to just get the expansion fee before they even try to operate a team for $250 million a year. It's probably wishful thinking, but that was one of the original thoughts that I had today as I'm reading this and growing a little bit more annoyed with each story I read.
Well, I'm annoyed as well. And I'm annoyed from the standpoint that I think having Andretti in Formula One is a good thing for IndyCar. I think it continues to spotlight, the fact that he participates in IndyCar and he participates in Formula One at the
Agreed.
Same time, just like McLaren does. I think the McLaren participation has been good for everybody. Maybe it doesn't receive as much attention in Europe, but I know more Europeans pay attention to IndyCar because McLaren's there. They have to. And so it's disappointing. And I think eventually it will find a resolution because I don't think Michael Andretti has gone this far with this many meetings and efforts to just let it go. It's not who he is.
Maybe it still gets done. If they up that expansion fee to $500 million. But I think doing the math, the Formula One owners are still going to say, that's not enough. What's in it for us? So I kind of had that thought this afternoon. I was reading, and then Will Flanders sent me a direct message, and I haven't read all of it, but I read it, and I think that he's kind of along the same sentiment as me. So I'm going to read this. Will says, I'm far from a marketing expert, but it seems to me that the time is ripe to attempt to recapture some American fans with the Andretti situation. One of IndyCar's greatest features is that it is open to anyone who can build a chassis and purchase a motor. Well, I'll pause there, and I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore. You can't really build a chassis anymore. You need to buy a DeLauro chassis. But I see what you're saying. You can go buy the DeLauro chassis, make a deal with Honda or Chevy, and go on. He continues to say, this stands in stiff competition to the closed-off model of modern F1 that essentially functions like a franchise model of traditional sports. I think a marketing push based on this narrative going directly at F1 could be impactful. Focus it around Hunkos knocking out Alonso from the 500 or small teams like Dreyer and Reinbold. I say this as a fan of both series, but also as someone who has been seriously put off in recent weeks by the notion that F1 wants American money while remaining a closed European club, rightly or wrongly, and I see a lot of other American F1 fans who seem to feel that same way. Okay, so there you go. That was one of the ideas that I had wondered about. Will this put off American fans? Maybe this is an opportunity for IndyCar to say, here we are. This is what we do. All are welcome, just like McLaren was when, oh, by the way, they failed to qualify for the Indy 500.
I just don't, the only, yeah, I agree with all that. I just don't like I don't like the notion of tearing down the opposition just to make your product better.
That's delicate. Yeah, there's going to be that takes a deeper think, and it's easy for someone on Twitter and for someone on a radio show to say, hey, let's go at them. But you're right. That does take a much deeper think. And it's one of the reasons why, because that notion has been said before that we need to go after them. And it's, I don't know that that really, I'm not sure. You have to be really tactical about how you do that. Because also keep in mind that one of the people involved, McLaren, is involved in both camps. And you potentially have manufacturers involved in both camps. And there's still some synergies there.
Yeah, and you're going to have drivers who still aspire to be in Formula One and who are racing in IndyCar. And by the same token, you know, you're going to have, and we want Europeans to be interested in IndyCar from a participation standpoint. You know, you can sit here and say, well, I don't like, you know, these guys I've never heard of. Well, it's our job, your job, my job, the show's job to help educate. I mean, you know, people who were on the Formula One path earlier in their career were guys who are household names in IndyCar today. You know, there are many of those Europeans who, you know, at the point they could have, if they could have chosen, they weren't allowed to choose, but, you know, go down through the list. We're starting to really get to know Christian Lundgaard. We're getting to know Callum Ilott, Simon Pagenaud, Elio Castroneves, Tony Kanaan. All these drivers were thinking, not just Europeans, but they were thinking about Formula One, just couldn't get there. And they've become stars in our sport. So I think we have to be a little careful what we wish for. I'm not in the business, because I don't think that's the right thing to do, as I said, is to tear down one to make yourself look better. We tried.
But there's still
that.
A smart way to do that, though, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, I think there's a
just
smart
accentuating your positives without
exactly.
demeaning the opposition.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we go back, you know, when NASCAR was really at its heyday, you know, IndyCar fans were put off by a lot of that. But I thought it required IndyCar and our sport to kind of look in the mirror and do things right and do things better. When NASCAR was succeeding, it wasn't an either or. I didn't think. I thought you could all survive and succeed and thrive. But some fans never saw it that way. And I'd hate to think we're going to go attack Formula One on this subject. I think we just accentuate the positives. We're, fast, loud and competitive series that should be celebrated.
You know, I don't think we got into this with Connor. It was kind of on my list of to-dos if we had time, and we had so many other good things to talk about. But I've heard him mention on his podcast before, maybe even mentioned it in our conversation, but I know he said it a couple of times on his podcast that he's disappointed that IndyCar has not marketed through social media the Alex Palou's and the Pato Awards doing free practice one. And I hear him. But I also would say it's not as simple. For example, I am aware of a high ranking IndyCar official who bristles a little bit at the amount of attention that IndyCar drivers pay to Formula One. And so that's a tactful situation as well. So it's not as simple as, I don't know what the right path is. It has to go the right way. I think I lean towards what Connor is saying, and let's use it to our advantage as well. But his question has been, why haven't we seen this on social media? Well, if I'm the person running IndyCar social media, I want to know what one of my bosses thinks. And I think one of the social media's bosses doesn't really want that talked about all that much. Well, maybe it can be reconsidered, but that's one of the it's got to be done the right way. And I don't know what the right way to do that without making IndyCar look like a minor league.
Well, I think you celebrate when your drivers are doing cool things, you know, the coolness factor. And I think the good example today, literally today, is IndyCar has celebrated its reigning series champion, Will Power, participating in the Rolex 24 at Daytona. He's got a ride. And what we do is celebrate the fact that we've got a contingent of guys going to participate in that event. And it goes from, you know, Scott Dixon, Simon Pagenaud, Elio Castroneves, and on down the list. There's about 10 drivers plus Indy Next drivers as well participating in that event. And I think you can celebrate the coolness of it. But you do want to walk a fine line and focus on the sport. So I think there can be some of it. I don't think you want to, you know, be a news outlet for every time a driver goes and participates somewhere else. But I don't think there's anything wrong with celebrating, you know, that other sports would like to have our drivers, and our drivers are capable of going in there and running well and competing well and winning races.
Well, I look forward to what the Andretti Group comes up next to provide more value for an entry, and then what excuse the Formula One Group has to say no, because that's right. All they're doing right now is trying to come up with an excuse to say no. So I'm still – it's going to take – someone is going to have to get behind this and convince them that this is what needs to happen. But if it's just a pure vote of the owners, I think it's still 70-30. It doesn't happen, and that is ridiculous. This should be the easiest slam dunk to include in your club that's ever happened before for Formula One, even before they partnered with General Motors. But whatever, good luck to you all.
Yeah.
I think it does help IndyCar, but a part of them being involved, and because I think so highly of these people, I really do like Michael Andretti and Mario Andretti and JF Thorman, and they've put I've gotten to know Dan Towris a little bit. They've put a lot of money and effort in this, and I want that to be rewarded. But just a little bit of me is, no, let's double down on IndyCar. And he told Bruce, I think he said this before, but no, we plan on having a NASCAR Cup team in a few years, but we need to get this Formula One thing sorted first.
Well, what do they got? Probably 5 to 8 different organizations that they participate in. So
I listed it somewhere. It's good. It would take the next segment.
Yeah. So that, you know, the bottom line is there are motorsports organization. That's what they do. They employ people. They use resources they have to capitalize on the success from one to the other. And they learn things. They develop, you know, by running Formula E, they've learned things to help their IndyCar program and vice versa. And they've got other, you know, partners that cross promote between different series.
So you can offer everything to your partners.
Exactly.
You want to be in a market, you want to be in a sport, we got that. Yeah, and here you go.
And the employees, you know, they've got something that offers employees. And by the way, as you mentioned, they're getting ready to build the coolest motorsports facility for a race team in the US. I mean, it's going to be as good as it gets. Up in Fishers, Indiana, which is a little bit northeast of the Speedway here. And it's a showcase for the sport, and it'll showcase IndyCar, and it'll showcase the Andretti's and all the employees that work there. And so it's such a good thing for the sport and a good thing for the city. I don't know why we're struggling with it, but I think we know.
Well, one of the other fantastic facilities is already built. We're going to talk with one of the key people later on in the program who's just joined them, Steve Erickson at Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan. I'm taking a visit to their Zionsville shop on Thursday. I'm really just going to visit with their sports car drivers to get some of my prep done, but that worked out better doing it in person because I want to see the building. I've not seen it yet, so I'll be able to report back next week on what that looks like.
How dare you venture off into sports car world when you're an IndyCar guy? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can go to Daytona. Every time I come back from a sports car race, I have all kinds of nuggets in the IndyCar world, especially when it gets late into the season like that. Half the paddock is going to be there. So I want to make sure I'm there as well. There's been more IndyCar testing already this year. We'll get into that. Do we have final seat announcements for the few remaining seats? We'll talk about what remains there and more coming up. Trackside 93.5, 107.5, The Fan.
Hi, this is Takuma Sato. You are listening to Trackside on 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
I saw today is Bobby Rahal's birthday. And then what's Arnie's official title with us? He's definitely a show contributor. He's a fact checker. So Arnie came up with, this is the day to be born. If you want to win the Indy 500, It's also Eddie Cheever's birthday, and it's Roger Ward's birthday as well. So happy birthday to all their family and friends and the individuals themselves. We've had race cars of an IndyCar variety on the track, and it's all part of what we still have remaining. We're still waiting to find out who the Ganassi Oval driver is going to be. Everyone thinks it's Takuma Sato. I've heard nothing saying it's not going to be, but we've not seen that announcement yet. We've got, we think and hope, a Junco's second car, Junco's Hollinger Racing second car that hopefully we hear something about soon. We've got combination maybe of Dale Coyne Racing drivers. And then we had testing last week of a few drivers. Not all are going to apply for right now. So I mentioned last week that we'd been hearing that Robert Schwartzman, who's an F2 race winner, was going to be testing for Ganassi, presumably looking at 2024, maybe to fill Alex Palou's seat. And he did test at Sebring last week. Stingray Robb tested with Dale Coyne Racing. Kiffin Simpson tested with Ganassi as well. And he has a development deal, and there's also a commercial deal involving, I think, essentially his dad's company or a company that his dad has major influence in. So, you know, so people have asked, well, how did these development deals come together for drivers? And, you know, I guess I would say they could come from a few different fashions, but the easiest way to look at it is money, whether it's IndyCar, Formula One, or anything else. So if you think at it from the team perspective, what is their advantage to doing a development deal with a young driver? Couple of ideas. One, in the Formula One world, the way it works is that drivers with budget, oftentimes their family pays so they can say that they're a Formula One development driver. And that means they get a nice golf shirt and they get to hang out on the pit stand for the weekend and maybe do some straight line testing or something like that. Now, then there are more real deals where they're driving the car and it's based on essentially having the rights to a driver. And that's how it could work in IndyCar as well. So it could be just simply you're doing a financial arrangement for that. Or it could be from the team's perspective. No, we think this driver is good, and they probably also have an access to budget, and we want to be first in line when they are ready to be able to sign them up. For example, Benjamin Peterson hung out with the Foyt team all last year. I don't know, but I think it's very possible that there was no money exchange in that. It was just they share driver coaches. Jonathan George coached Benjamin Peterson, also coached Kyle Kirkwood. There's the connection right there. And if you're Larry Foyt and you find out, yeah, this kid's in Indy Lights, he's pretty good. And oh, by the way, he has budget. Sure. Why don't you hang around the team? We'll get to know you. You get to know us. And when you're ready to move up, maybe we have an advantage over someone else. And I think that could be the possibility with Kiffin Simpson as well, because he does come, to put it mildly, well-funded. And remember the Ed Carpenter Racing announcement for Josh Pearson, who's driving everything. So you know there's budget available. He's driving Indy Lights. He's driving Le Mans. He's driving IMSA. And by the way, I think he's pretty good. So that's the perfect combination. And from Ed's perspective, he might have like a right of first refusal that, you know, this seat would be available at some point. This is the budget that would be required, but you're going to bring that to us. And if so, so I know I got off on a tangent there, but that made me think of that. Cause I've had that question asked of me a couple of different times.
And, you know, to make sure we introduce it properly, we talked last week about starting to hear from the teams, you know, and what their plans are for 2023 and how are things shaping up. And as we head into the test that's coming up at the end of the first of next month at the Thermal Club in Southern California, we're going to talk with Steve Erickson about the Ray Hall Letterman program and where that's headed and what's new for 2023. And we were going to start with the Foyt team. Larry Foyt went to last night's college football national championship game to support.
Probably wishes he would have just done the interview.
To support TCU, which is his alma mater and based there in Fort Worth. So we'll try to get to Foyt next week. But the reason to have Steve Erickson, in addition to the fact he's a prominent player in the paddock and has been for a long time, and now is with Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan as their COO, it is, you know, a double, it serves double purpose to start talking about the teams that will compete in the 2023 season. And Ray Hall Letterman is first on deck for that.
So speaking of Foyt, they do have news. We had kind of heard some of these rumors, but they, I think, have added a really big piece to their program.
Yeah, Michael Cannon is going to lead that engineering group. Michael's outstanding. I mean, he has kind of flown under the radar, doesn't quite get the recognition that a lot of those engineers get. He's a really sharp individual and has had a lot of success through the years. He kind of is a quiet person in the paddock. You don't have a lot of reason to have him on television. You don't have him on a radio show like some of the other engineers that we've had over the years. But Michael's one of the really gems of the paddock, and I think he'll bring a wealth of experience to the Foyt team.
And I wonder if he maybe thrives even more in that type of environment. Now, he did help win a championship. He was Scott Dixon's lead engineer there. Yep. So he did get it done with the big boys, but he has overachieved in all of his previous, you know, a lot of times those teams were, well, why is that car so fast? Well, one of the reasons was Michael Cannon. So I think this is a really good fit. They hired a new team manager, Craig Brooks, who's been the technical director for Indy Lights for a while, and he's worked in IMSA as well. They've hired some new mechanics, so a lot of things there. Scott Harner moved on. Has that been announced? I think he's with Andretti now, but I may be wrong about that. There's a lot of musical chairs, and I take it you don't recall that. I don't know if I've seen that in a release or I've read it somewhere or someone told me that.
Well, and I'm with you as well, because I meant to reach out, as I reached out, I should say, with the Foyt team the other day.
So please don't quote me on that. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe I got him with the entirely wrong team, but I'm pretty certain Scott has a job. He left Foyt, and I believe he has a job in a good position for next year.
And I agree. That's why I was going to ask the question. Hey, where was it that Scott went? And I'm with you. I think it was Andretti, but I haven't seen a release per se.
Yeah. So there are a lot of changes. It's not just driver changes. It's engineers, it's team managers and things along with that. So we talked a little bit of a test and there's not, I don't think there's really anything else until we get to thermal, right? Yeah. I don't think there's anything on track.
That's right. A lot of the drivers are going to be testing with the Daytona Rolex 24 Roar at the 24 test coming up here in what about 10 days. Roughly. And so I think the next time IndyCars are on track at any place will be the Thermal Club on February 2nd and 3rd.
Okay. So I'll get a quick check at social media and see what we got going on. Get you set for hour two and more on the way. Trackside 93.5, 107.5, The Fan.
Hi, this is Will Power, and you're listening to Trackside.
Some good tweets coming in, John, Mitchell, and more that we'll do at the end of the program tonight, but this needs to be a short segment. So we get ready for three full guests coming up in hour number two, including Steve Erickson in just a little bit. And up next, Dylan Welch from Abacus Racing is at the Chili Bowl. He's also our correspondent and works for NBC. And he's going to talk short track midget racing coming up next. Trackside 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Hi, this is Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to Trackside.
Hour number two. Thanks for staying with us. Trackside 93.5, 107.5, The Fan in Indianapolis. Kurt's back with us in just a few moments. You know it's the new year. You know it's time to go racing. We've talked about IndyCar testing a few of them at Sebring last week. We're getting more announcements about the Rolex 24. But it really feels like the new year because the Super Bowl of short track racing is going on right now. The Chili Bowl is going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and our yearly correspondent, Dylan Welch, who's been able to do some other things in media as well with NBC Sports on IndyCar, IMSA, and NASCAR coverage as well. And Dylan is not just our correspondent. He is our active driver correspondent, competing again this year for Abacus Racing, which is an Indianapolis-based team owned by my friend Brent Cox, who is the official CPA of Jackson Lee Racing and the Lee household as well, with Cox, Beckman, Goss. I think they just rebranded. They just rebranded to, I believe it's Cox Goss, I think is now. I'll have to look that up on that. But anyway, that's another story. Dylan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Kevin? Thanks for having me.
I'm well. So you're available to chat with us tonight while cars are on track as we speak. You've stepped outside to lessen the noise a little bit. But if they get done with in between the session, feel free to walk inside because we want to hear a little bit of car noise as well. But you'll be on track Thursday?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and I'm right outside the building, and they just pushed off another heat race. So you'll probably get to hear them here in a minute because that's obviously excellent. Pretty loud still outside. But yeah, go Thursday and looking forward to trying to get our car in the show again.
So explain to our IndyCar fan base, if they haven't heard this conversation this time of the last several years, what makes this event so special? Why is it so unique?
Well, and that is the word, I think, is just unique. You know, it's all indoors, obviously, and the building here in Tulsa is just gigantic. I mean, they have a racetrack, trailers for 380 cars, and a trade show all under one roof. You know, so just a massive, you know, undertaking, and every year, you know, like 15 or 20,000 people, you know, come to this race and attend it all week. And so it's very intimate, you know, but it has a big event feel. It feels like the event is kind of too big for the building, you know, which kind of adds to the excitement. So you might be able to hear the cars are going.
Oh, yeah,
now,
we can hear it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the entry list this year? What's the number?
I think it's like 370 or 80 or something like that. It's down a little bit from last year, but still obviously quite a bit. Yeah.
Down. And 24 of those get to make the big race. So normally you go to a weekend and it's all right, you know, there are 35 cars here, 11 of you are going home, or maybe there's even 50 or 60 or 110, like we had something like that at the first BC 39. 370.
Yeah, that's the crazy part, and that's what I think makes, you know, this race even that much more prestigious, is that, you know, even if you're in the top, I mean, 50 or 100, you know, you're still not making the main race. So it's an incredibly difficult and challenging week to just put everything together, not have anything bad happen to you, and kind of take yourself out of contention by something that's not even your fault. So it's a lot that goes into just preparing to be successful out here, and that's why it means so much to so many people.
I think it started last night. Was yesterday the first?
It was,
day.
Yep.
So let's kind of explain this, and then you take it from your perspective as a driver, what has to happen. But I think essentially there are five different solo events leading up to the Saturday, correct?
Correct. So Monday through Friday are preliminary nights, and they take all 380 cars and divide them into 60 or so cars a night. You race on one of those nights, and it's just like a normal dirt track show when you would go to your local dirt track. You run practice, you run heat races, and then you run, you know, qualifiers or lower mains. And then they advance 24 cars to each preliminary night's A main. And then basically based on either how you finish in that night's A main or just how you finish overall, if you're in a B main or a C main on your prelim night, that seeds you for Saturday. So if you finish in the top two on your prelim night feature, you're automatically locked into the A main race on Saturday. And then I think if you finish like third through eighth, you go to a B main on Saturday. And that's for everybody. That's, you know, Monday through Friday, third place through eighth place finishers are, you know, seated in a B main or C main or whatever it is on Saturday. So your prelim night is obviously super important just to, you know, get yourself started off on the best foot on Saturday to try to make the main race.
So if it does not go well, if you crash, get collected, whatever, then you're starting in alphabet soup. Explain alphabet soup and trying to wake your way forward. You know, if you're starting at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon in the double E or whatever,
yeah,
where do you have to finish in each of those races out of how many to advance. And then keep in mind, the next race, you're starting in the back.
Right. Yeah. And so it changes. It changes kind of as you get closer to the A main, but it's usually like four, like they take top four, top five, or top six. So, you know, depending on what lower main you're in, you know, it maybe is a little different just because they try to keep the car counts a little lower and stuff. But yeah, it's like if you finish, you know, if you, even if you win your lower main, you go to the next highest main and still have to start 16th or 17th or something, you know, whatever it is. And then you got to get all the way through those cars just to get back to the top four to keep racing. So they start, you know, on Saturday at, I think, like 9 or 10 a.m. With whatever the lowest main is, you know, the Q main or whatever, you know, whatever it's going to be this year, and race all day until they get to the A main on Saturday. And there's been guys that have raced like through five or six races before. And like just a couple of years ago, a guy from here in Oklahoma raced, advanced through, I think, like five races and was going to advance to another one and got wrecked in the final corner.
And oh, wow.
Everybody was up in arms about it and stuff. So it's really, Saturday's really, you know, an entertaining day. And if you're a race fan, it does not get any better. You can show up with your coffee in the morning and your breakfast and put your butt in a seat and not leave. And you can watch racing all day long.
Dylan Welch is joining us, and you've made the A main twice out of these 300 some cars. How far did you have to come the 2 years you made it? Where did you start on Saturday?
I was in a B main both years.
Okay.
So I had to start at the kind of towards the back. Like I started, I think 16th 1 year, and then maybe like 12th or something last year when I made it. So, you know, still had to pass cars. And that's the thing too, you know, these B mains and even the C mains, anywhere else in the country, that's a main feature. You know, it's multi-time yeah. national champions that are in these races because they only take the top two from your prelim night. So even if you run third on your prelim night, which is a great run, you're still, you know, in a B main. You still have to race your way in. So it's the best of the best, you know, and again, that's why making the A main is so impressive, you know, for anybody. And every year it's hard because it is truly the best, you know, assembly of race car drivers of all disciplines, you know, under one roof.
Who are the NASCAR stars that are here?
I think this year it's just Chase Briscoe and Alex Bowman, because Larson's not here. Bell is not here. Ricky Stenhouse is not here. So I think it's just those two. Josh Balicki is actually racing. He's a Xfinity series, and I think maybe run some Cup Series stuff too. But he races tonight, actually, I think. And then on the IndyCar side this year, it's just Santino. So I think he races Friday, but obviously good to have him back and giving it another go too.
You think Santino is Friday?
I think so.
That was
yeah.
my next question. I just pulled up his social media to see if he had posted that, and he is not. Yeah, here I see Bob Pockris posted. Carson Hocevar is also doing it. He's a truck driver. He used to race quarter midgets with Jackson, so I've known Carson since he was whatever, 9 or 10 years old. JJ Yaley, who we see in both worlds or have seen, is one of the other ones as well. Connor Daly, I think, was smart enough to realize I might just want to focus on the day job. Been there, done that. That seemed pretty hard. And then Santino took a big tumble last year. I'm kind of surprised he's back.
I was too. And to Santino's credit, you know, he raced the Tulsa Shootout a couple weeks ago, which is basically the Chili Bowl, but except for mini sprints, which are just smaller versions of a dirt midget, basically. But they have like five or six different classes and over like 1,500 cars in that race. But he raced that a couple weeks ago just to try to get some more laps and some more experience. You know, to try to make his week here at the Chili Bowl better. But yeah, I was bummed that Connor didn't come back. You know, I've obviously watched him the last couple of years, and I thought he was kind of starting to get it figured
He's
out,
been better.
You know, and thought he looked good. But this place will humble you in a hurry for sure.
MAV TV, is it on MAV again on Saturday?
It's all on Flow Racing this year.
Oh,
so
is it really?
Everything is on Flow from yesterday through the Saturday features.
Well, I get that from their perspective because and we looked into actually buying it last night. Jackson pulled it up, and you can't buy it for the week. It's $150.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a tough sell because, honestly, I'm pretty busy, and I'm not watching a lot of other offerings that they have. But I get that their business model, they figured this is the way to get people in. So that's unfortunate.
I think too, you know, the thing to consider, too, is that most nightly streams are anywhere from $30 to $40. So even if you buy all five nights of prelim action, by the time you get to Saturday, you're basically watching for free. So I know that, I know people are up front, you know, or are scared maybe of the 150 up front, but the Flow Racing or the Flow Sports platform is really awesome. And they got other stuff besides racing. They've got, I mean, collegiate athletics and, I mean, it literally anything you could want, basically. So I would encourage people, if you're thinking about it, I know that 150 sounds like a lot, but it is totally worth it. And you will see some great racing this week and the rest of the year, frankly, too. You can watch all of USAC. You can watch Tony Stewart's All-Star Circuit of Champions. There's plenty to watch that you'd be watching for free, basically, after you get through the Chili Bowl.
Well, I'm all for it because you know what? It makes that $5 a month for Peacock sound pretty, pretty good. Yeah,
that's right.
I think that might be a pretty good value on that. All right, Dylan, we'll be following along. I either will pony up for it this weekend or I'll have to find my favorite watering hole that has the broadcast on and just to enjoy it that way, or I'll find a friend that has the broadcast and go visit their house as well. Good luck to you. Oh, what's your teammate's name? I know Brent has a teammate that he's pretty high on.
Yeah, his name's Daniel Whitley. He races Wednesday, and a young kid from California who should be exciting. He stands on the gas, doesn't have a lot of midget experience, but raced for Brent's team out on the West Coast a couple months ago, and I thought he was pretty impressive. So excited to see what he can do tomorrow.
Abacus Racing is the team, and I looked it up. CGCPAs now, formerly Cox Beckman Goss and Company. So Brent's always been a great connection for us as well. He owns a suite at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. These are the kind of friends that you like to have. And I know he loves being involved in short track racing as well. Good luck to you guys. And you've got a big month, right?
That's right. Yeah.
You've got a few things going on before you get to Daytona even.
Yeah, get married. Gosh, probably 10 days from now or so on the 21st.
I hope you know the day. 21st. Okay.
Yeah. We'll be honeymooning at the Rolex. So it doesn't get any better than that.
So I'll be at the Roar for you and report back. And then we'll see you the following weekend for the Rolex 24. Good luck to racing and then to you and Hannah as well. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
That's Dylan Welch. I looked it up. The number 58 Club Sport Abacus Racing midget for the Chili Bowl this weekend, and also one of our co-workers on NBC Sports. So we thank Dylan for his time. Kurt joins us again. Have you ever been to the Chili Bowl? I'd love to go, but I don't know that I want to be sick for the week afterwards that everyone appears to get.
Yeah, I've been there several times, probably four or five times years ago. I mean, not that, I guess about a decade ago. And you're right. You deal with, you know, you're without getting too graphic, you're cleaning out your nasal passage for about a week. I don't know that you feel sick, but there's a lot of smoke in the air. And, you know, you're basically running in a cow barn, basically, with 300 and some midgets at different points during the night. And, it's a lot. It's certainly sensory overload. And when I've been there, I've only been there like Friday and Saturday nights consecutively. So I can't imagine.
Week.
Yeah, I haven't been there for like a week long activity. I just never thought it was important enough. In fact, few of those times when I went, I would do stories for Auto Week and I would just be there Saturday. And that's a lot in itself. So I applaud the guys that have the courage to stay all week because it's a lot.
I also think one of the reasons people come back not feeling their best is maybe they're not getting a lot of sleep either. You know, you get done racing midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. or whatever, and they may not go directly back to the hotel. So, sometimes that has a little bit of factor involved in it. A few other notes in this segment. I think we're up to 17 confirmed Indy Next, formerly Indy Lights confirmations. James Rowe was confirmed last week in a really good situation for him. He split time last year with a couple of teams. He won an Indy Pro 2000 race at the end of the year before, but he's going to complete the Andretti Autosport lineup. And I'll have a little more on where things stand. They have their content day coming up on Friday in Indianapolis, where they'll do a lot of production, and I'm going to go out just to have a chance to get a lot of stories from all the drivers. That was very productive for me last year preparing for the broadcast. So I'll be able to meet all these drivers. I think I've probably met all of them, but just spend some more time with them coming up on Friday.
I'll be there as well. And it was really beneficial for me as well, just to sit in a very casual sitting 20 minutes, probably with each driver. And I'll come away with a lot of nuggets myself.
And I was talking about development drivers a while ago and the incentive for that. And I guess the other final aspect of that, along with locking in a driver for the future or maybe just straight cash, you know, the other thing that might come to play with some of these would simply be connections for partnerships. And for example, that might be what a Kiffin Simpson brings as much as anything, is that the connections of his father's company and his father's connections to other connections. So there may be some opportunities on that for that. And I hope we see more of that moving forward. You know, you want to see IndyCar teams involved as much as possible with ladder teams, whether it be Indy Next or quote road to Indy, for lack of a better term, because I've not heard one yet. So I'm still calling the USF 2000 and USF Pro 2000 the road to Indy. But there are some potential synergies there on that front. We'll get more into IMSA and the IndyCar participants, but the Will Power connection is pretty cool. And maybe it just got announced because the team just got added in. The Sun Energy team, this is Kenny Habul's team, who is a fabulously successful Australian-American business person who is a very good race car driver as well, and a great personality that I've gotten to, I wouldn't say know, but spend some time with the last couple of years in Daytona. His entry was not included the first time around. I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. They had interest from something like 70 to 72 cars, and they don't have that room. So they were talking about 61. The first entry list came out at 60, and then they came back a few days later and added a 61st for Kenny Habul's team, and that's the team that Will Power is going to be involved with. That is a GTD program, so it's like the Vassar Sullivan Lexus team. And I know Will has been wanting to do this for a while. All of the Penske drivers have been wanting to do it. We've gone where none of them do it. Now all three of them are in programs this year at the Rolex.
And Kenny and Will actually grew up relatively close to each other. Kenny's from Surfers Paradise, and of course Will is from Toowoomba, and that's not more than a couple hours apart. They raced against each other in Formula Fords back in the day, and mm-hmm. have followed each other's careers as they've gone along. And as you mentioned, it's a successful businessman / relatively good race car driver. And so he's also, he won class, Kenny did, in the Bathurst 12 hour. And so, and in fact, he finished second in the Intercontinental GT Challenge race at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I started to say Raceway Park, but so he has, you know, there's an interesting pathway if Will wants to get to Bathurst in the future.
And they finished, Kenny's team did second or third in the Rolex within the last couple of years. I haven't gotten in my research yet, but I remember them. I was in their pit and they were contending. So this is a good seat and a great opportunity. A couple of the nuggets I've seen when I was throwing out names that still might be possibilities for the remaining IndyCar seats. I mentioned Pietro Fittipaldi. I think we can probably cross Pietro Fittipaldi off because I first saw that he was joining a full-time LMP2 team for the World Endurance Championship. That doesn't necessarily mean that he couldn't do it. I didn't really get into the schedule. He's also still, I think, a reserve driver for Haas F1. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But beyond all of that, then he was announced as a driver for Rick Ware Racing in the Rolex 24 in their LMP2 program. And I think that's for the full season. His tweet just said for the LMP2 championship. So between those two programs that may or may not require budget, I don't know, but they certainly require time. I'm going to guess, I mean, I suppose he could still be a part-time participant if somebody needs to piece something together, but probably not as likely to be involved in IndyCar with getting a couple of other things off the ground. Here's a nugget I saw too from Nate Ryan from NBC Sports, and maybe others had it as well, but he tweeted that Chicagoland Speedway is going to be back in action this year. They will be the second track in the inaugural Super Motocross playoffs on September 23rd. So I go back to Dumb and Dumber. So you're telling me there's a chance. If the racetrack still is functioning to some extent, maybe not the full extent, but there's still a racetrack of some form there, and they are willing to accept fans, then maybe someone can resurrect it for some type of racing in the future. So I thought that was worth mentioning.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We all love Chicagoland, so let's keep our fingers crossed.
All right, coming up in just a moment, we're starting an impromptu mini-series where we're going to try to visit with someone from all 10 teams. Yes, should know that. Look that up. 10 teams.
Yeah.
Here in the next couple of months, different teams. Some have one car, two cars. Some have four, five car, whatever. So our first guest is going to be from the Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan Racing Camp, and it is timely because he just joined. So he may not have all the ins and outs on everything because he's just working on his key card at this point. But Steve Erickson certainly knows IndyCar racing and motorsports from his vast background. And he's on the show coming up next. Trackside, 93.5, 107.5, The Fan.
Hi, this is Graham Rahal, and you're listening to Trackside on 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
Welcome back to Trackside, and we are now about 3 weeks from full on-track activity in the NTT IndyCar Series, the first open test just 3 weeks away, February 2nd and 3rd at the Thermal Club in Southern California. And as promised, we're taking kind of a reset with the teams to discuss some of the changes they've made during the offseason. And one of the biggest really is a management restructuring, maybe not restructuring. Maybe let's get into it here in just a minute with Steve Erickson. But Rahal Letterman Lanigan has beefed up its organization, not only with a new technical director, Stefano Sordo, who comes from Formula One, spent the past 6 years at McLaren and also at Red Bull before that, among other teams. But Steve Erickson joined the program, I think actually yesterday, first day. And Steve had been 30 plus years at Honda Performance Development, been a vice president, now comes as the chief operating officer at Rahal. And so, Steve, thanks for joining us. Day two of your job, I guess. What's that transition been like after a couple years? I guess that was the IMSA program at Chip Ganassi Racing.
Yeah, last 2 years I was with, as you mentioned, with Chip Ganassi, and that was a very interesting learning experience for me because I was, you know, thrown into the deep end, so to speak, on the team side as the race team manager for the sports car program. And that was pretty exciting because it started out as a one car program with Cadillac, turned into a two car program. So that, you know, there's a lot of work in getting another car together from scratch, and realizing, you know, just how much extra stuff you have to buy once you've bought a car to make it a complete car. And, you know, traveling to all the races and doing all the hours that a race team does was, you know, a good learning experience for me.
Do you have to think differently as a team guy as opposed to a manufacturer guy as you had been? I know the competition still burns in your belly the same, perhaps, but how different is that from just a day to day perspective?
You know, it's interesting. Certainly, the team side, in my experience so far, was much less structured on the business side. Much more focused on just the pure competition side. You know, what's making us go faster and kind of everything else just followed in its wake, if you will.
I would expect, you know, the facilities at Rahal were an impressive part. It's not the reason you take a job. Of course, Rahal just announced and just moved into a new facility north of Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But day one yesterday of moving in, day two today, give me a kind of a, just a walkthrough and meeting kind of new people and seeing what all the team has to offer now.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, yesterday was my first day and I had not toured the facility in advance. So literally I walked in the door and that was my first time to see this beautiful new facility. It's impressive. It's visually, it's quite amazing. And the layout is quite sensible with the, you know, BMW program on one side and the Honda IndyCar program on the other side. And then the support entities spread out throughout the building. But yeah, it was really nice. There's a lot of old faces that I've worked with over the years from my time at Honda that I got to be reunited with. There are a few folks that I had worked with at Ganassi that now work here. So that was nice. And then there's a whole bunch of folks that, you know, I was meeting for the first time. And one of the things that struck me was how many new people there are here. If you know, if you look at the size of the team, it's grown significantly in a relatively short amount of time.
Of course, Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan will field the same three cars in 2023. Graham Rahal in the 15, Jack Harvey in the 30, and Christian Lundgaard in the 45. But as we said off the top, Steve Erickson, who's our guest in this segment, you're part of what is really a beefing up of the management staff. Stefano Sordo joined as technical director, and then they have a really strong core. Ricardo Nault, VP of IndyCar operations, Derek Davidson, the team manager, and then the engineering staff and so forth. Tell me how this dynamic works. How does the flow chart, the organizational chart, how does all this come together from the standpoint of your role and how everyone works together and how to make this team take the next step?
Yeah. And in my role, I'm going to be working with kind of both sides of the house. Obviously Ricardo I've known since I first worked with Ray Hall Hogan in 94. So we've known each other for a long time. You know, Ricardo's got Derek is the team manager and Stefano is the technical director. He's got a great suite of, you know, engineers under Stefano, you know, Eddie Jones, Alan McDonald, Ben Siegel, Mike Armbrister, Neil Fife. So they've got a really, really solid lineup. They've got some great simulation folks. You know, the facility is still, I would say, getting all the bugs worked out. It's so new. But, you know, there's space to grow, which is great. And, you know, it's certainly a very impressive facility.
So is there like name tags and everybody's new offices need to have like directions on how to get there? Is that kind of the new school approach?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I literally asked Ricardo for the, you know, plan view drawings of the building just so I could figure out which direction I needed to go to find the right person. But it'll become very, very natural here shortly.
So from a competition standpoint, this team has, won its last race in 2020 at the Indy 500, Takuma Sato going to victory lane. But before that, it's been quite a while. 2017, Graham swept the Detroit weekend. Talk about just the expectations, that come with this organization. And, you know, stepping into a team role that victory is, you know, now a more difficult thing to come by than it was at Honda when you were a 50-50 proposition. Let's talk about the expectations the owners have and how that, how that plays in day to day, because it's an important thing. You know, Hy-Vee's a great partner and you have, of course, many other partners in this organization that needs to see results.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the hiring of Stefano was a big step in that direction because he brings in kind of a fresh perspective, particularly in a world of Formula One where, you know, you have a lot more flexibility to do, you know, a wider range of types of testing and approaches. You know, he's been through all that and seen what is best bang for buck and is bringing that viewpoint into the team and working with the seasoned IndyCar engineers to understand the unique aspects of IndyCar racing and blending those two points of view, hopefully to raise the bar here.
So Steve Erickson joins us, new chief operating officer of Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing, but Steve's been such an integral part of the paddock for a long time. Does it help your relationship with Honda? Do you expect there to be a positive influence from team side back to Honda, or is that relatively insignificant since most teams have, you know, such a great relationship with their manufacturer?
I think it helps in that I can provide insight. You know, if in the past they were always used to dealing with one or two people and knowing that, oh, well, they just have the team viewpoint, I can provide the viewpoint of knowing both sides and better explain the things that the team is doing in a way that Honda will go, oh, okay, I see this is really headed on a great path here. Let's watch and see what happens here.
Do you have... You had been in, you know, I guess you are an engineer, I guess, mm-hmm. by trade. What role will you have in the, I mean, it's not, the engineering side is not your direct responsibility, but it's kind of everybody's aspect of the program. How will you utilize that in this new role?
I mean, largely, you know, a request from Bobby was, you know, to allow the technical competition folks to do their job on the competition side. My plan is when I see something where I can contribute, you know, like from my perspective, having worked with many different teams over the years and having been in charge of R&D activities for IndyCar projects within Honda, you know, I'll contribute where I think I can add some value on the competition side, even though that's not my direct responsibility.
In other words, see something, say something. Isn't that yes. kind of how it works?
Yep.
I also read, Steve Erickson joins us, I also read in your taking over this position that one of the things that interests you in returning to IndyCar was the future of the hybrid system, the energy recovery system that is going to add some changes to the sport here in the next, you know, really calendar year. How do you see this transition for IndyCar and pros and cons and the interest that it should bring?
Yeah, you know, it's having gone through a big chunk of last year working on the IMSA side with its energy recovery system, that was quite interesting to see and potentially has some foreshadows for what IndyCar might experience. I think now that Honda and Ilmor have gotten more hands-on with the system and you know, trying to make sure that it's a fully reliable and fit-for-purpose system is a real plus. And I don't think, you know, teams are going to have their hands on things until, you know, Honda and Ilmor sign off and say, yeah, this, you know, this thing's ready. We've tested it. We put it through its paces. We run it on the dyno for, you know, forever. And we've done our own track tests, et cetera. Once that, you know, that box has been ticked, I think it's going to be quite exciting to get it into cars and start to learn how to use it. You know, what is the best way from a competition standpoint to use this new tool?
It'll be fun. You got the test at Thermal here in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
IndyCar has not raced there. It will not race there. What should be the objective for the teams going to a facility where, again, it's not a known quantity? What should the teams hope to get out of that test?
I would certainly see it as a shakedown and a practice operationally with members, because, you know, through the off season, you know, there's always changes as we're talking about earlier in staffing. So it's a chance not only to exercise the car itself, but also the folks that surround it that are so important in making a success in a race. So I would see it as kind of a shakedown for both man and machine.
Well, you're certainly at the forefront of that as in your new role with Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan Racing. Steve Erickson joining us. Steve, thanks for taking some time. And it's I know it's good to have you back in the IndyCar paddock. And I'm sure you're going to feel like a natural part, even though you're kind of taking on a new role. And, you know, keep those Honda guys in shape because, you know, we know how they can cause trouble in the paddock. So keep them in order.
Absolutely. I'll do that.
All right. We'll be back to see what we missed and go through any last minute news items. Kurt Cavan, Kevin Lee, 93.5, 107.5, The Fan.
Hi, this is Marcus Erickson, and you're listening to Trackside on 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
Thanks for staying with us. Final segment tonight on the program. And we all like to learn about places we can hear and read about motorsport. And there's a new offering that we're going to explain that's going to be in the marketplace very, very soon. We welcome Daniel Incandela to the show, and some in the IndyCar community will maybe remember that name. And certainly those that work in the sport would know Daniel. I met him, 15 years or so ago when he ran the digital department for IndyCar and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And then since then, he's worked for software companies as a marketing executive, but his family has a history in motorsport. His dad, Sal, was the owner of the Indy Regency Racing Team, but he started as a Formula One mechanic and then came to America and was involved as an owner in IndyCar, Indy Lights, Toyota Atlantix, and much, much more. Daniel, it's good to catch up with you. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Kevin. And that was a great recap. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So your new venture is called Podium Life.
That's right.
I think first explain, let's give a short synopsis of what it is. And then you're in the software business now. You no longer work in motorsport. What brought you back to motorsport?
Well, I'm a race fan for life, so it's hard to get that out of the DNA. And I have followed racing religiously since I left the Speedway just over 10 years ago. So it's something I'm still passionate about. And one of the things I have realized as a race fan is that if I am searching for all the great products out there that allow us to be better race fans, there is no centralized location for that. You have to know the brands or the websites and search all over place to find them. So if you're looking for the latest in esports gear, the latest artworks coming out, books, gear, merchandise, you name it, Podium Life is going to aggregate and curate all of those things into one location. So that as race fans all over the world, completely agnostic of what series you're following, can come and join Podium Life and see what's out there.
So we really needed you about a month ago when people are asking for book ideas for Christmas gifts and things like that. So this is going to be a great resource all year round, but certainly next year as well. Now, what's the connection to what you do now? I'm going to guess your skill set now gives you an advantage over your traditional editorial type of background.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm describing this as a fan, but this is very much a business endeavor. And so it's great because it combines my background back to the days of when I worked in racing, which was digital strategy and content strategy, and now combines it with what I've been doing in the software and technology space, which is marketing. And so we're taking storytelling from racing and turning it into a business. But it's really about celebrating the fans. And so we want to showcase all of the great things out there from all over the world. But we also want to start telling different types of stories behind the great culture of racing and learning more about the lifestyle and what goes on behind the scenes. So it's going to be a combination of incredible products that you can buy, but also behind the scenes looks into, you know, what is a driver pack in their personal backpack when they go to a race weekend? What headphones do they use? What are their sunglasses? Things like that. Mm-hmm. So that fans can be better race fans.
And then I'm assuming you're going to get into the stories behind racing personalities. It might not necessarily just be drivers. You know, some of the things that we in the TV world talk about that we want to give fans a connection to these drivers, but it's often difficult to do in the confinements of a television broadcast. That's something that you can do with more feature-oriented types of stories.
Yes, and I'm very proud to be an Indianapolis resident, and that this project is born here. But the fact is, racing is celebrated all over the world. So we want to tell stories from all over the world across every potential series. And those stories are important. I think it builds a stronger connection to the culture of racing. I think what we've seen from Drive to Survive on Netflix is that has had an incredible effect on all forms of racing and has created younger and newer fans that I believe are hungry for different types of content. And so we want to bring those stories alive. An example of that is if you think about someone like Toto Wolff from Mercedes in F1, who has taught classes and done studies at Harvard University around leadership. And so how can we bring leadership advice from other team owners or others in the field of motorsports that I think readers and race fans could connect to, mm-hmm. and build a stronger allegiance to a team or a driver or whatever it is. But racing has been going on for over 100 years now, and we want Podium Life to celebrate everything that goes into that. And again, it's all about the fans.
Daniel Incandela is joining us. The new venture, the magazine, is called Podium Life. I cannot even begin to think about what it takes to start a venture like this. First of all, is this all digital, or are there hard copies involved?
Initially, it would be digital, although we'd like to do an annual publication in the future. But as of right now, it'll be all on podiumlife.com, which we are launching at the 24 Hours of Daytona on January 25th.
Okay. And then I saw Joseph Newgarden tweet about it the other day. So he's involved in some way, or is kind of like me and just said, hey, I know you, Daniel. I want to help you any way I can.
So there's four of us that are co-founders, myself, my friend and colleague, Stephanie Capucci, Brian Simpson, who I worked with at Speedway and is still involved in racing and runs Dream Digital. Yeah. And then lastly, Joseph is also a co-founder, has been very involved in this. And between the four of us, we've been driving the strategy and all of the work behind the site. And then I am hopeful Joseph will help promote it down at Daytona with some of his friends to make the biggest splash.
Yep, we'll stay on him for that. And for those that don't recognize the name Brian Simpson, I don't know if we'd give him full credit for it, but he was on the ground floor of Bus Bros with Joseph and Scott McLaughlin. And he does a lot of the creative and the digital assets for several drivers. Really, really talented. And you guys worked together back in the day, so we know his work. And so that lends a lot of credence to this project as well. So the 25th is when we'll be able to find it. Any sneak peek of anything that we can look forward to, a feature on anything that we should look forward to in that first issue?
All kinds of content. So I think you're going to be blown away by all the things out there for race fans. Some predictable, some totally weird. It's been fun researching that. But I think if people are that excited, you can actually go to the website right now and sign up, so you'll be the first to notified. We have some content and a video on there right now, but we'd love for you to sign up so that we can let you know immediately when it's launched. And then we want more ideas. We want to capture everything out there, and I think we've done a good job, but I'm sure we've missed some things.
Daniel, it's good to catch up with you. I wish you all the best. We look forward to following and reading and learning more.
Same to you, Kevin. Thanks so much.
Daniel Incandela, the new digital magazine is called Podium Life, and you can find more at podiumlife.com. It debuts January 25th ahead of Rolex 24 weekend. All right, a couple of other nuggets. I see Jimmy Johnson tweeting that he's got big news on the Today Show tomorrow. It may just be simply announcing that he's driving the Daytona 500 and what the car number is and the sponsorship, but I'm still not ruling him out for the Indy 500 or something related to IndyCar, because there are still seats available with Ganassi, with Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan. You know, can they work out the Chevy Honda thing? So I'm going to say there's a chance there, and there's maybe some other things that we'll learn. We got to learn some things here really soon, so stand by on that. Cam Soup SL said, was there any talks about IndyCar going to Las Vegas instead of F1? And if there wasn't, why? Why is money? F1 is the shiny new toy right now. And as much as we would love to see IndyCar in a street race, it's majorly expensive. And the new hip thing to do is Formula One. And that's what got that past the finish line. Hey, maybe if that doesn't work down the road, there's the infrastructure in place for an IndyCar event. But no, I don't think that was realistic at this point. Paul asks, Gene Haas's team has struggled since entering F1. Why will Andretti's experience be any different? Well, it could be better funded. More money equals more of an opportunity. And Haas has not been that bad. It's not like they've been a disaster. They have had their moments. So I think they have actually positively shown that you can come in as a new entrant and be competitive relatively quickly. And we're really out of time. So John Day, thank you for the tweet. We'll get more. John asked about the latest on Sato. We talked about that a little bit. TBD, stand by. Next Tuesday night, only an hour, 8 until 9. Join us then here on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.